Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
We're back. It's 12 after. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and my website is www.jbsba.com. Don't forget to subscribe to my free newsletter. When you get there, it's easy. It's free. It comes every week by email. Think you'll like it. We're now in our 50th year of our Small Business Advocate newsletter. Richard DeKayser and Michael Menzies are our guests, ladies and gentlemen, this hour. And we're going to talk about a lot of different things. We're going to talk about the economy. We're going to talk about national economy. We're going to talk a little bit about more local economy. We're going to talk about banking. We're going to talk about your ability to make a profit in your business and how to work with banks as well. And we're going to talk about working with big banks and little banks. And we're going to talk about the Fed. We got a lot of things on our plate today. And I can't think of anybody better to help us do that than the two top bankers and our Brain Trust members, Richard DeKayser and Michael Menzies. Michael is the president of Eastern Bank and Trust in Eastern Maryland, beautiful downtown Eastern Maryland. Richard DeKayser is the executive vice president and chief economist for National City Bank, which is a large bank out of the Midwest. And Michael, welcome to the show.
Jim, thank you. Great to be with you.
It's good to have you back, Mike. And Richard, it's good to have you back too.
Always good to join you, Jim.
Say hi to Michael.
Good morning, Michael.
Hey, good morning, Richard.
Let's get started talking about the economy. And what I'd like to do is we got two perspectives here, folks. Richard is part of a larger bank, National City Bank Corp, and I'm going to get Richard to talk to us a little bit about the national economy. And Michael is sort of a little more where the rubber meets the road out there I guess I shouldn't say flyover America because it's on the eastern shore. But Michael, why don't you start out? Tell us how things are going in small town America.
Well, I guess certainly if Easton represents small town America, our economy is strong. I'm not sure if it's driven by the same fundamentals that we've enjoyed over the past. We have been an agricultural economy and a poultry economy. And while that industry is healthy, for sure, here on the eastern shore of Maryland, much of our economy continues to be driven by real estate. And if it were not for the explosion that's going on, from what I can see in rural America, of people leaving suburban America and going into rural America and building houses, our economy wouldn't be as strong as it is today. But that's just sort of a quick and dirty observation. Things look good right now, though.
All right. Well, I think that's an excellent observation, and I think that speaks to one of the big drivers of the economy. No question, housing is. In fact, there's a recent report that said that was one of the reasons why the economy was one of the recent Fed reports was why the economy was growing so well. Richard, why don't you give us a national perspective?
Oh, sure, Jim. Things are looking pretty good these days. Year over year, the economy has grown at a 4.9% rate in terms of real GDP. That's the quarter ending in March of this year. You know, by standards of comparison, around 3% is what folks consider generally to be normal, so well above the normal rate of growth. And while it initially began with some transitory factors, and I'm talking here about some tax cuts, about mortgage refinancing, spikes that we've seen at least two over the past year, we're now seeing an economy that seems to be much more well-grounded. Consumers are spending not because of these one-off occasions, but are increasingly spending because they're getting jobs and generating real sustainable income. And we're also seeing a transition to a business investment-led economic expansion, whereas, you know, prior to a year ago, businesses were still very wary. There's a lot of uncertainty. They were very reluctant to commit. And increasingly, they are forward-looking and engaging the economy. So we're seeing both consumers and businesses take to the lead in a way that really suggests a more viable, self-sustaining economic recovery than the kind of economic recovery based on steroids, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, and here's something that I read recently in the Wall Street Journal, Mike, to speak to your point. There was a study looking into what caused the deflation scare, so to speak, just to kind of net it all out. And the study finds, I'm quoting here from the journal, the study finds that two-thirds of that decline in the core inflation rate reflected slowing increases in rents and rapid declines in used car prices. Now, Mike, that's kind of what you were alluding to when you were talking about people moving out of the out of downtown areas, maybe moving out of a rental house and maybe owning or an apartment and being able to buy their first home out in the country. That's you were sort of alluding to that, weren't you?
Yeah, and I think that, and I really enjoy Richard's perspective on this issue I'm about to address, but my concern about the sustainability of our economy is just that, is that we've had this unbelievably low interest rate period of time that was certainly justified following 9/11 and following the dot-com bomb and following the economic adjustments that come from the that came from the 90s. But so much of our economy, at least as a community banker, appears to have been driven by debt and low rates, and so much of our consumption appears to have been driven by rapid acceleration of house values. At least in our neck of the woods, it's been at breakneck speed, like 20% a year for 3 or 4 years. And I think a big question I have as a banker is, can we sustain the debt-based economy, and will income and real earnings and real savings overcome the levels of debt that we've accumulated at a federal, at a state, at a corporate, and an individual level over the past 4 years?
Richard, it sounds like Mike is asking the question Mr. Greenspan seems to have asked in the last year or two, and that is, could we be heading toward a real estate bubble?
Well, Greenspan has weighed in on that, and his opinion is no, but I think it's a lot less clear. Let me make 2 points. First, regarding the low level of inflation we've seen as of late, you are quite correct that a large part of that has had to do with the very low interest rate environment and the fact that people are moving out of apartments into houses. Today we have the highest home ownership rate our country has ever enjoyed. At the same time, we have the highest vacancy rate our country has ever had in apartments.
Mm-hmm.
Now this has a weird effect on inflation statistics because the way the government measures the cost of home ownership is they say that, okay, us homeowners are in effect kind of renting ourselves property. And the place they get their signals for the price at which we're renting ourselves property is by looking at the apartment market. And because the vacancy rates have been rising there, they say that home prices have not been rising, as we know they have, 7-8% a year, but in fact have been basically flattish because they're looking at the apartment market. So it's a kind of a funny distortion, which has to do with the way statisticians compile things. Now, to get to the point about
debt, Richard, would you hold that point? Because we've got to take a quick break. You know how this works. We have to stop every so often and sell something. And we're going to do that right after these messages because our economy has got to keep going around here. 20 after, we're going to be right back with Michael Menzies and Richard DeKayser, our top two bankers in our brain trust. We'll be back right after these messages. Stay with us. We're back. It's 23 after. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. We're visiting with Richard DeKayser, Executive Vice President and Chief Economist with National City Bank up in the Midwest part of the United States. And over on the Eastern Shore, Michael Menzies, President of Eastern Bank and Trust, an independent community bank. Richard, I stopped you. You were making a point.
Well, yeah, let me talk about the residential real estate market because I think Mike's got a good point. It's been front and center for the past year, and hence I think a lot of people are concerned about what may be going on here and can it last. First, let me put it in perspective. If you look at our economy, consumer spending is about 69%. Business investment is about 11%. Those are really the big engines that keep the locomotion moving forward. Residential real estate is about 5%, and even if you throw in realtors' commissions and so forth, maybe you get up to 6% of GDP. So its relevance to the economy is not as important as its impact has been generally, I think, in the media. Now, Mike's point is a good one, which is that the 40-year low interest rate environment that we've been enjoying for the past 2 years has added to rising property prices and increased borrowing and a record level of household debt. Now, I'm not particularly concerned about the debt situation right now, and I'll tell you why. As people have borrowed more and more and more, they have at the same time basically reduced the burden of this debt by refinancing. So people are taking 12% credit card debt, they're folding it into 6% mortgages, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. There is a risk, however, and that is to say, if at some future time interest rates move sharply upward, and I'm not talking a percentage point, but two or more, then the burden of this debt is going to start to rise because a lot of it's on an adjustable basis, resetting every year. And at that point, then, we could start finding people struggling under the weight of their debt. But if I look at the world right now, and even into the immediate future, it doesn't terribly bother me.
But, Michael, and Rich's points are well taken, but the thing is, the truth is that a lot of those mortgages have been, a lot of people have gone ahead and gotten the fixed mortgages because the fixed prices were, interest rates were so low that they just went ahead and locked them in, and the result was America got a huge cash flow pop because of refinancing some of this debt, didn't they?
Well, something that I don't know if we know is how much of the past 3 years of GDP, of the 69% of GDP that's consumption, has factually been driven by debt. Mm-hmm. And recognize that, if my numbers serve me right, the credit card industry at the end of the 90s had something in the order of $2.5 trillion of outstandings. Granted, a lot of that had to do with credit card float going into frequent flyer miles and that sort of thing. But this refinance boom transferred something on the order of $1 trillion plus out of the credit card industry onto homes. So we've taken 24-month payment obligations and turned into 30-year mortgage obligations.
Mm-hmm.
That coupled with this home equity explosion that just seems to be out of control, where the tax laws drive us to use our homes to buy our cars, puts us in a position where we've just, in many cases, used this inflating real estate market as an engine to drive consumption. What I don't know is of the roughly $7 trillion in mortgage loans that were written over the past 3 years or so, 3 or 4 years, the biggest refinance and finance boom ever, how much of that ended up going into consumption as opposed to the creation of new assets, and mm-hmm. how much of it went into consumption of new assets versus refinancing debt or, you know, buying just disposables. I don't know if anybody knows that.
Yeah. Richard?
A couple organizations do surveys periodically. The Federal Reserve has done surveys on this in the past, and I think the Mortgage Bankers Association has done surveys on this in the past. And just some rough figures, which aren't going to be accurate, but are going to be pretty darn close, is that for every dollar of mortgage refinancing which has gone on through increased debt, that is not just a refinancing of existing loans, but a increase in debt amount, has basically gone divided into three parts. Number one, one-third has been going for home remodeling and fix-up, the new kitchen and all that sort of thing. The other third has gone for debt consolidation. This is the substitution for credit card financing. And the other third has just been plain old spent, cars and so forth. So a big chunk of it, though, to be sure, not all. And let me just try and bring this home as to where exactly the rubber does hit the road, as you would put it, Jim. If I have a $100,000 mortgage and then I refinance it and take out $20,000 and now I have a $120,000 mortgage, in all likelihood, I'm still paying a lower monthly mortgage fee as a result of the movement in mortgage interest rates from 9 down to 8 down to 7 and at 1.6%. So I've bumped up my mortgage from 100 to 120, but my monthly payment has declined.
That's the cash flow.
That's right. Now, moreover, the value of that house has actually gone up. So now I'm still at 120,000, but as we've seen home prices soar over the past couple of years, on a net worth basis, my debt's gone up, but my asset value's gone up even more. So household net worth has actually been rising rather than falling. Now, this gets to the final point, which is where are home prices going? And I know the Maryland area has been one of the hot spots in this country. Washington, D.C. area, New York, Boston, mm-hmm. San Francisco have all been absolutely sizzling. And I think it's very legitimate, especially from a mortgage banker's perspective, to worry about the sustainability of those price increases.
Richard, I've got to stop you because we got to take another quick break.
Sure.
When we come back, I want to get Richard and Michael to weigh in on what all this information, this excellent information that they've been giving us, What does all this mean to a small business owner? How should we take this information and turn it into opportunity or check ourselves for challenges? 29 After, stay with us.
Now back to Ringside with the voice of small business and the champion of the entrepreneur.
Say it now, gentlemen. Undisputed heavyweight champion of the world.
The small business advocate, Jim Blasingame.
We're back. It's 34 After. I'm Jim Blasingame, and I'm glad you're here. My website is www.jbsba.com, and if you have a question or a comment, the best way to do that is email, and it's askjim@jbsba.com. And we'll get that question answered and that comment. If you got a if you got a little critique, I'll take those too. So don't worry about that. Just send me a note at askjim@jbsba.com. Richard DeKayser and Michael Menzies are our guests. They're our top two bankers in our brain trust. And Richard, I actually had to stop you as we were going to a break. Was there anything was there a point that you needed to make that before we go further?
To a large degree, there's a part of the economy that's wrapped up in the residential real estate market. There are certain areas in the country where I think we need to be on our toes at the risk of overvaluation and subsequent correction. And the Washington, D.C. area would be one such place. But yeah. Here is my point. This is not the case, in my opinion, for the country as a whole. It is the case for a few glamour markets, which are very touchy right now. But if you look throughout the industrial Midwest, much of the South, the agricultural Midwest, there is, in my opinion, no evidence whatsoever of a bubble. So it's something that's pretty market-specific and a concern perhaps in those markets, but not pervasive through the country as a whole.
I want to talk now about what all this means for small business owners. Michael, you're out there holding small business owners' hands who are maybe having difficulty. You're helping some young pups grow and get their business off the ground. You've got some mature companies that have an opportunity to become larger companies. You're working with those guys, and what are you helping them with? With all the information we've talked about, all this economic news that's out there, the good, the bad, and the ugly, what do you think that they should be doing with this information?
Well, while I don't pretend to fully understand these business cycles, it seems to me that when economies contract, small businesses pull in their belt and they tighten up on their expense side to offset the decline in revenue, and they're positioned to grow again. And it seems that's where we are. There are small businesses that are positioned to grow again. One of the challenges, it seems to me, is that as this economy aggregates, and it's aggregating everywhere, as Richard knows, it's aggregating in securities and insurance and real estate and finance, it just gets more competitive as the economy grows. So I think small businesses need to be on their toes from the standpoint of productivity and figuring out how they can deliver intense quality service and products productively. We just lost last year the Black & Decker plant here in Eastern Maryland, which was 1,400 employees, and we lost that to Mexico. They've gone to Mexico, and they're now seeing that China probably can produce these drills even cheaper than Mexico.
Right.
So my only observation is that whether you're a big business or a little business, if you're not tuned into ways to be productive, ways to leverage your resources more and more, then your horizons are not as bright as they could be. Niching the business and productivity, to me, are the survival tools for small business. If you just think you can sit back and smile because you have a friendly face and everybody knows you in the community and you'll hold your margins as a result of that, mm-hmm. That's gone. It is a very competitive economy that we live in today.
Speaking of, well said, Michael, and speaking of margins, one of the things that that the Fed chief said, Chairman Greenspan said recently, Richard, is that pricing power is gradually being restored and threats of deflation, which were a significant concern last year, by all indications, are no longer an issue before us. Small businesses are finally getting a little pricing power. We're finally able to pass along some of the increases in our expenses, our costs of goods sold, and our operating expenses. We're finally able to pass a little bit of that along, aren't we, Richard?
To some extent. I wouldn't overstate the case. I mean, the financial markets are certainly swinging as though we've gone from deflation to hyperinflation, but the reality is we've gone from no pricing power to a little bit of pricing power, and it's going to depend largely on who you are and what you do. I'd say the principal source of renewed pricing power, that is the ability to bump up prices, really would be in the hands of those who confronted a lot of import competition. You know, the dollar's fallen about 15% over the past 2 years, and when it was at its peak, as it was in the late 90s and into the 2002, it was darn difficult competing with imports that just got cheaper and cheaper by the day, only because the exchange rate made them so. Well, that's gone into reverse, and a lot of folks here in the U.S., domestic manufacturers, are finding it increasingly possible to steal back a little bit market share, maybe increase their prices, and if you're in that niche, it's certainly an opportunity you want to exploit.
Stand by, Richard. Stand by, Michael. We're going to take a quick break, folks. It's 20 till. We'll be right back with our two favorite bankers in the brain trust. And when we come back, we're going to talk about oil prices, fuel prices. Are they high for now? Are they coming down? Are they going to stay high? We're going to ask our experts that right after these messages. Stay with us. We're back at 17 till. Let me remind you, coming up in the hour straight ahead, Christina Cavanaugh is going to join us. And we're going to talk about how to do a better job of managing your email. It's a very important topic. And then after that, we're going to talk about salesmanship with one of our top salesmanship experts, Mr. Brad Huskin. That's coming up in the next hour. We're still visiting with our good friends, Michael Menzies, president of Eastern Bank and Trust, and Richard DeKayser with National City Bank. Let's do the website thing. Mike, give us yours, please.
But our website, it would be www.easternbankandtrust.com.
Easternbankandtrust.com. And
yep.
Folks, if you want to go see what a really cool independent community bank website looks like, check this one out. And Richard, give us yours, please.
Very simple. Nationalcity.com.
And Eastern Bank and Trust is, what are you guys up to now, Mike? About $70
million? $70 million? Golly day, you're talking about whose checking account? we hit $106 million at the end of the month last month.
All right. Well, good for you. But I got old news. I got old news then, Michael. But I do remember when you were down there in the 65, 70 million range.
So do I.
Well, good for you, Mike. I'm real proud of you guys, what you guys have accomplished over there in Easton through some tough times, too, I might add. And Richard, tell us about your bank.
Well, National City, it's a major regional bank. I think we're eighth or ninth in the U.S. rankings, total assets about $120 billion, and we go from Michigan and Illinois in the north down to Kentucky and east from Pittsburgh to Indiana in the west. So it's basically the Great Lakes area.
And they were going to go into Maryland, but they found out Menzies was over there, and they said, we better back off on Maryland a little bit. Yeah. Okay, petroleum. Guys, this is a real shocker for a lot of us, and that's the price of gasoline, especially gasoline, but other products that are made from oil, from petroleum. Here's what Mr. Greenspan said about it. He said, if the rise in long-term prices of oil is sustained, and this is a quote, it could alter the magnitude of and manner in which the United States consumes energy. And he also talks about how it could alter the way business investment decisions are made. Michael, tell us about that. What do you think?
Well, you know, I certainly have less than 1/1000th of 1% of the perspective of Father Greenspan, but when he makes a statement like that, it certainly causes me concern. In our neck of the woods, everything is petroleum. I mean everything. We're an ag region and a building region and retirement region. Our corn comes as a result of planting seed and harvesting it, and that's all driven by petroleum. And our poultry industry is only competitive because our basis is really low here. We consume about 130% of all the grains grown in the region to feed poultry. Poultry is an incredibly competitive industry. There isn't a whole lot of room to – there isn't a lot of pricing power typically in poultry because the cycles are so long. So if energy prices creep above $2, then it could really hurt us really badly. And housing, too. I mean, housing is all driven by energy. Mm-hmm. So what I don't understand and what I'd like to deposit in Richard's court is that the world oil prices, I'm told, retail, are somewhere above $3, like $3.50 or $3.75. And we're able to keep our prices under $2. Is there any reason to believe we can sustain that And if we can't, then how much is that going to kick us in the teeth?
Well, the reason gasoline prices are cheaper here than they are throughout most of the world, not all, but most of the world, has to do with taxes. You know, when you pull up at the pump, somewhere between, depending upon what state you're in, between a third and 40% of what you're paying is federal, state, and local taxes. Now, in Europe, they tax their gasoline at a far, far higher rate for a variety of reasons. One, they find it an efficient way to raise revenue, and two, they find it a good way to limit fuel consumption, that is, to protect the environment. Now, we haven't gone quite so far down that route, and as the relative price of oil and gasoline in this country has fallen, the kind of consumption decisions that Greenspan was referring to are right in front of our faces. You find one person driving 8-cylinder trucks and SUVs, and that would not happen in an expensive gasoline economy. So if we're making that transition, that's just one way in which we're going to start altering our behavior. And frankly, some of this is perhaps overdue. You know, we've become a very fuel-laden economy, and to some degree that's been unnecessarily so.
Well, one of the things that I'm convinced of is in my own dangerous amateur way, guys, is that we are in for, I believe, long-term prices being near where they are right now. One of the reasons is because of the increased consumption in other parts of the world, and I think the days of dollar and a dime gallon gasoline in America are long gone and may never be back, and certainly not for a long time, if ever. I want to move over to the Fed. I've got a minute and a half before we go to the break, and then I want to finish this up as we finish up the hour. The Fed meets tomorrow, Michael and Richard, and what do you think they're going to do? Richard, are they going to raise rates?
No, I don't think so, Jim. That's certainly in the cards, and in my opinion, not before long in June or August, but I don't think we're going to see that happen at the May 4 meeting, and the reason is simply because they've been following a really, really good practice with what they call transparency of communicating their intentions mm-hmm. before their actions, and we haven't seen that a sufficient broadcast.
So you think today they're going to telegraph and maybe do something in June or August?
Well, that's the better place to look. I think that they're going to start altering their message so as to lay the groundwork for rate increases coming shortly, but again, not tomorrow.
When we come back after these messages, I'm going to give Michael an opportunity to give us his opinion on what he thinks the Fed's going to do when they meet tomorrow. And then, of course, as you know, you're not going to get away without getting my opinion on this, my genius opinion of what's going to happen coming up. I already made my prediction. I made mine in January. I predicted in January the one time the Fed would raise their rates in 2004. I'm sticking with that, and I'll tell you what that is right after these messages. 10 till. We'll be right back with Michael Menzies and Richard DeKayser.
Roll away again. Yeah. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay watching.
We're back. It's 7 till. Richard DeKayser, Executive Vice President, Chief Economist with National City Bank, is with us, along with Michael Menzies, the President of Easton Bank and Trust in beautiful downtown Easton, Maryland. And Michael, we just got Richard's report on what he thinks the Fed's going to do. He says they might telegraph a little bit this meeting, and he thinks maybe raise rates if they do in June and August. Hope I'm not paraphrasing you incorrectly, Richard. And
well,
Michael, Michael, go ahead.
Well, I'm sure there's going to be a 100 basis point move this week to prevent Mr. Buffett from backing up Mr. Kerry. I think that the Fed will lag the market, as it typically does. I think that rates that go up will not be driven by the Fed. I think it'll be driven by the economy. And the corporate refinancings, the government refinancings, the growing economy and the demand for money just kind of by itself all alone will be the basis on which we see rates rise over some period of time. And I think the Fed will kind of react to that rather than proact to it. So just one perspective.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, In January, I predicted that the Fed would raise rates one time this year and that they would do it in June and not later. And I'm sticking with that. And I'm sticking with that. And the reason is because I think the Fed could raise rates a quarter or half a point, and nobody would it wouldn't bother anything. I mean, I think in my own perspective, the 1.5%, even a 1.5% Fed funds rate and 4.5% prime rate is not going to hurt anybody. And they could do it without upsetting the economy too much, especially, Richard, if they gave the telegraph, as you mentioned, if they prepared the markets for it, it wouldn't be so bad. And I definitely think that they're not going to do anything. I don't think anything's going to happen to cause them to need to do it between June and Election Day. I just don't see them doing that. I don't see them even making any appearance that they might be affecting the outcome of the election. Richard?
Well, you know, let me put it this way. The Fed would prefer, as they of their own admission, if you read the minutes from past meetings, they would prefer not to be in a high-profile position as the election's in the heat of the moment. However, they would by no means whatsoever allow an election to prevent them doing from what they think the economy needs, if they think the economy needs a change in interest rates.
If we got to the point where it was needed, but that's the reason why I think they'll go ahead and load it up in June, just as a precaution.
You mean get ahead of the curve?
I'm disagreeing with Mike a little bit. I think maybe they might be a little ahead of the curve instead of behind the curve, whereas originally, I think, Mike, you're right. I think historically they have lagged.
And who knows? I think that the issue is that the Fed does have a job, and it's going to do its job. And I think Greenspan has proven that he's pretty apolitical. He's going to do what he needs to do to maintain stable prices, and that's.
Richard, Mr. Bush, Senior, complained a little bit about what Mr. Greenspan did to him in the last Bush election.
Sure, he complained to no avail.
But he considered that to be one of the factors in him losing the election.
Well, I don't think it helped. You're talking about the election of November 1992.
Right.
He complained that the Fed didn't lower interest rates fast enough. And if you go back 4 years prior to that, in the election of 88, the Fed, at that time again, still the Greenspan Fed, actually increased interest rates at least a half a dozen times between the start of the year and the election. So I think there's a lot of history, at least under the Greenspan Fed, to do what they view as right for the economy and to maybe acknowledge the political cycle, but to not let it weigh on their decision-making.
Michael, 20 seconds. Talk to small business owners. What should they be doing right now?
Well, it's time to capture the flag. The economy is growing for sure. It's time to go capture market share, not necessarily giving up margins, but delivering the best quality you possibly can. And the only other thought is focus on productivity. There isn't anybody in this economy who doesn't need to be productive to continue to compete.
Well said. Richard, 20 seconds.
I'd just like to remind folks there's a sale going on now, and if you haven't been to the sale, you should. And that what I'm talking about are the tax breaks for investment purposes. Mm-hmm. These were passed in an environment of concern and worry about getting the economy going again. They're going away at the end of the year to a large extent, not entirely, but largely. And if you're pondering an investment, you need to recognize that you've got only about 7 more months to exploit this opportunity.
Up to $102,000 in direct expensing for small businesses that are profitable. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Michael. Good job today. Well done, both of you. I'm looking forward to doing this again. Thanks a lot to both of you.
Thank you.
See you later. Bye, guys. Got to go for this hour. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners. This is Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. I'll be right back.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.